This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Randall O'Wayne's memoir features the standard ingredients of a classic country song: beat-up trucks, plenty of cigarette smoke, and a nostalgia-soaked father-son relationship. But his book, Meander Belt, Family Loss and Coming of Age in the Working Class South, ends up being a much more nuanced reflection, one that follows Randall's twisting and perhaps unreliable memories of the violence and the hard love that defined his upbringing. Randall O'Wayne is an assistant teaching professor of creative writing at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and joins me now. Randall, welcome. Good evening.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
This is a coming-of-age memoir that doesn't bring us into adulthood. Talk about the structure of this and your idea about it going in.
Well,
to the present, I guess I should say.
Well, in a certain sense, it does. The final chapter, Into This Place, was written after the book was contracted by Nebraska, and it involves this moment of finding foliage, bloomage, deep in the woods, and it ended up being this quince bush that was flowering that I'd never seen before in my land in West Virginia, and so then I kind of rescued it, and then as I was rescuing it, I saw lilacs there too, and so I rescued it from greenbrier vines and blackberry vines, and then I saw dandelions and narcissus, and I realized that I was excavating the original homestead's front yard at this moment, and for me that was a beautiful moment, because I left Memphis, which is a majority of this book takes place, having left Memphis, and then also the what is lost and what's at stake with that leaving. And to be honest, and that was 2000, and for a long time I still called Memphis home, and in a way I still call Memphis home, even though that was 20 years ago. But West Virginia, that was one of these early moments of feeling that it was welcoming me in a certain sense, that it was gifting me a new home, and discovering that their names were Highlanders. So discovering Nellie Highlander's homestead was one of those. So I actually really liked ending with that moment. It doesn't say explicitly that it was so recent, but
right. But so much of it does take place, and I mentioned the idea that perhaps you even comment on the reliability of memory, and that
Absolutely.
Seems to be a deep theme and a thread that runs through your memoir.
Absolutely, yeah. For me, okay. So we understand that memory is fallible. And that's very important, especially in terms of like a court case, you know, when a jury needs to judge the evidence. And a lot of the studies based on neuroreceptors and memory have been done in order to sort of help the legal system. But for me, I lost my father and my brother in this 3-year period. I was 22 and I was 25 with each of those events. And it was a complete restructuring of who I was, my entire identity. I became someone who had grief. I became someone who had lost. And that young, when no one else around me had, felt like I'd also become a new species in a certain sense. It entered my body so fully, this grief, that I couldn't disassociate that story from the fiction or screenplays that I was working on at the time. And so it kept slipping into that other work, and it was awful. It was just really bad fiction, really bad work. And so it was frustrating to me. I never had this desire to write a memoir or this desire to write about myself or my family. I don't think I'm that interesting. But these stories kept happening, and they kept infiltrating my other artistic endeavors. And I felt them so physically. Every time I would think of my brother, my father, Memphis, in relation to those men who raised me, I would feel it in my guts, not in my mind, not as a cerebral intellectual experience. It was bodily, and it was as if it was as if my mind was trying to compartmentalize those experiences and sort of to set them aside, and so I when I started writing this book, I wanted to write from that bodily experience. I wanted to write from that place of my guts and my heart, which meant that I needed to inhabit that world.
That's a different way of accessing memory, isn't it? Because when I, you know, when you go, when you're playing the trivia game, there's one way of getting at the information, right, and opening these various doors
into
this box that's got that category.
Yeah.
But when you're talking about the bodily scar-laden memory of a thing, how do you even know where to find that? And how does it speak to you? Because it may not even use words, or does it?
Well, for me, it showed up as horribly bright cinematic moments, and that's what I wanted to capture.
One of the ways, let's talk in particular about this, because Chapter 9, for instance, 13th Street and Failing, and I haven't decided yet, maybe we'll read something or not, but it's, you know, it starts out, on this day, I lie the death of Wes Tudell.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the whole essay then weaves in other stories, and then you come back to this and in the course of several pages sort of recontextualize your whole idea of this episode, which you had not even told, which you were at some vague level aware that you were lying about the whole time.
Yeah, well, when we're young, and maybe not. I mean, maybe it happens into adulthood. But when I was young, there was this need for more drama and cinema in life, you know. And if life wasn't moving at this grand cinematic level, then it wasn't moving. And so then you seek greater story or lie. And what I wanted to get at in that essay is what. So I lie the death of this kid who's disappeared, you know, and I knew I was making the lie up. But then when it became truth, I was also welcoming truth, meaning to everyone else. I was also welcoming that response from others, so we could seep ourselves in the drama of that death. It was way more complicated, obviously, than just I am going to make this lie up and then this thing is going to happen. It was more of a convincing of oneself. But then some years later, as I write in that essay, I'm having band practice, and the band next, and this is in a storage unit, an aluminum-sided storage unit, and the band next to us is waiting for my band to finish, and they start banging on the door, and we go out, and this Jeep has come off of the highway and slammed into a pole, and they sadly watched the accident happen. And then we only see the Jeep, and then the drummer and I go and search for the driver, and we find her, and she dies with us right there. We're holding her hand when she does. And so then, you know, having this lie of death and then experiencing somebody else's tragedy firsthand absolutely recontextualizes the need for that drama. And that essay, I think, is important for a lot of the book, because when my father and my brother died, it was so, like I said before, such a massive alteration. Where does that kid, that 17-year-old kid who lies the death of Wes Tudell, where does he get off? You know?
Right. Well, because the death of Wes as your lie was a convenience for you. It let you off the hook to some degree. And then when the palpable reality of death crashes in, a bloody one at that, suddenly you have to go back to this invention of yours and feel the grief of it, which you had hoped was the whole point of the lie.
Yeah, and that's a really great way of saying it, too. It let me off the hook. Yeah. I was feeling down in a way that kids do, that I didn't know how to, like, fix. And so then I tried to find an outlet for it. I'd fished for one.
Let's talk about that relationship with your father in particular. It was a complicated one. Talk about who your father was and a little bit about your relationship.
Yeah. So my father was a carpenter. He came from small town Arkansas. His family were laborers, migrant farmers, all the way back. But he, unlike his brother, for example, wanted very badly. His ambition was to sort of like create and maintain, home ownership, two cars, solid family, you know, And he worked very, very hard for that. I mean, he rarely took a day off during the week. He was also a self-proclaimed redneck hippie, you know? Mm. So he had like long blonde hair. He was beautiful. He was a beautiful man, you know, 6'3", these watery blue eyes. I was telling Grant on the phone, he looked like a redneck Fabio. Anyway, you know?
the redneck Fabio. Yeah. There's the image that will not leave us.
And he would like in the summer, you know, this was the, you know, like the 80s and the 90s. I don't think people dress this way anymore, but you know, you'd wear like cut off denims that were so high up that the pockets hung below the hem.
Daisy Duke.
Yeah, you know? The Daisy Duke. That's what my brother and I called him Daisy Duke. We were so embarrassed, yeah. You know. He was a charming, funny man. You could go anywhere with him, and everyone would say, "Hey, Chris," when he walked into the gas station or anything. And then he ended up with just this really just hard time. You know, there's a suite, a trilogy in the middle of the book, the Momentum Mori suite, and the first one, Calls in the Night, tracks my father's sort of descent that begins with these just very intense panic attacks that were not readily diagnosed in 2000, 2001. And so then the doctors, in a certain sense, were telling him it was in his head, that he was sort of making it up. And there's nothing worse than you can say to a carpenter whose ambition is to provide for his family that he's making up something in his head to get out of work. And so then that just made the panic double down, and he missed a lot of work. He went back and was putting up a ceiling beam in a church, a fake beam to make it look like it had been timber framed, and two discs in his spine herniated, and his boss of 15 or 16 years fired him before he was even at the hospital, so he didn't have to pay insurance. He had to sue to get his hospital bills paid, and that isn't even how he died. That's just like this part of his life. And for me, this interesting contrast was happening because I was on this great ascent. I was living in Olympia, Washington. I had a band, a record wanted to put out our label. We had a U.S. tour set up. It was everything that I'd wanted to achieve in the moment. And so that's always been really hard for me to kind of pair sort of downhill and me not returning home.
It must have been difficult for you too when you wrote your first book and handed it to him.
Yeah. So I like this story. I wrote a book when I was 19. It's awful, as you would expect, and I hand wrote it, and then I got all of my roommates together to type it up on a borrowed typewriter. We didn't even have a computer. We had a typewriter. Typed it up on the typewriter. I got a book from the library on how to make signatures, you know, and collated it. And then my mom sewed them together, sewed the signatures together on her sewing machine. And then I put it in a bag and I took it around town and I sold it to people. But I gave it to him as a Christmas present. This is like one of those moments of tension. And he set it on the TV, didn't even open it. I'd inscribed it. I have the copy that was his, and I'd inscribed it something along the lines of, if you hadn't taught me about hard work, I wouldn't have been able to finish this book. Our ways in life are not that dissimilar. And he stayed on the TV for some days, and I came home New Year's Eve, New Year's Day at that point, drunk, and was like, "Are you going to read it?" And he said, "Now I'll get your mom to tell me what happens." You know, and I was like, "No, but I mean, I wrote it. I want you to read it." And he looked at me. And he had this way of looking, as fathers do, that is this challenge, you know, like step over the line. And he said, "I don't expletive read," you know. And I was like, "Fine," you know. And I thought about that a lot because it did end up obviously creating a fissure in our relationship. But I now see it. I mean, I was a wild animal, you know, and not one that I would wish on any parent, you know. I mean, I left their house at 16 and was fully capable of taking care of myself and did. So I caused them a lot of grief with that momentum. But what they didn't know how to deal with, what they had no model for, was this idea to become an academic or become a writer or become a musician, because I'm the first person in my family to go to college or anything like that. And so they just absolutely did not have that model. My father was still talking about father and son carpentry businesses. He couldn't really see that I'd grown like far beyond that possibility. And so I see in that moment a frustration with him. He didn't know how to respond to me, and he was also losing me.
Yeah, I mean, your book meant I don't effing play with wood.
Yeah, right.
And this caused you to reflect on masculinity as well. Certainly another deep thread and theme that runs through the book. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah.
I mean, that in the ways in which your ideas, again, have changed over time, and you reflect this in the way these essays are put together. It's change over time, ideas that then have to change and become recontextualized because of new events.
Exactly. I mean, I think when I think of it, when I think of the masculinity that I come from, it's more rooted in loyalty than it is in the patriarchy. Hmm. It's less about this dominant household figure, like that Will Ferrell skit on SNL where he's like, I have 12 men under me, you know, I drive a Saab, you know, it's like, it's less about that kind of domination and more about it's a necessity. And I would say that it is rooted in a very difficult and desperate kind of love, because when the discs were herniated in his spine, it became very clear, very fast, that was our asset, his body. That was our asset. There was no trust fund, nothing like that. We were depending on a body, a 48-year-old body, to carry us through, right? And I feel like that is the masculinity that I come from, right? The need and the ambition to be that man, to be that body that carries us through. And yet we know how fragile that is. And so, you know, my mom has crocheted images of Murphy's Law, what can go wrong will go wrong, hanging on the wall. Because we're always sort of standing on a thin ice. And so I didn't come from a very toxically masculine world where manhood was like sort of crammed down my throat. You don't let anyone punch you, you know, and you stand up for those that you care about. But the most important aspect was you stay loyal to home. And I did complicate that by leaving.
What, I've only left you a minute for this one, but what did you said you really didn't intend to write or didn't want to write this book necessarily. What was the process like for you, and how did you come out of it?
Yeah, the book itself, I think was a good experience for me. I'll try to tell this story very, very briefly. One of the things that I did not anticipate was memory in a certain sense, or at least that physical reaction to memory, is almost like a finite resource. It's something that I was mining, and I didn't realize that I'd mined it out, and then therefore tied my memories more so to this book than to the actual events. Because you put it down on the page, and then you go over it and over it and over it again. And I wish somebody would have warned me.
Well, this is the warning.
Yeah.
Don't ever write a book, says Randall Owain, creative writing professor at the University of North Carolina. Randall Owain is the author of Meander Belt, Family, Loss, and Coming of Age in Working Class South. He's an assistant teaching professor of creative writing at UNC Chapel Hill. Randall, what a pleasure. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
You can find out more about the book and his creative process Saturday, February 8th and 9th at OK All Right in Durham, or February 21st and 23rd, actually through the 23rd, at the North Carolina Book Festival in Raleigh. And all of that is on our website, stateofthings.org.